From Maine Public Radio, from Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Monday, April 10th, 2017. And on this day, Governor Paula Page and legislators look to take general assistance costs local and make it harder to get GA. And one doctor's argument for lifestyle medicine. That's ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by the Law Offices of Joe Bornstein, dedicated to serving injured and disabled Mainers from Kittery to Caribou. JoeBornstein.com. And by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
First tonight, let's take a look at what's been going on in Augusta. General assistance, the welfare program that helps low-income Mainers with rent, food, and other necessities, is administered by local cities and towns, but most of the cost is picked up by the state. Maine Governor Paula Page wants to eliminate that state funding, and lawmakers are also considering other bills designed to make it more difficult to get GA benefits. Mal Leary has that story.
Among the proposals before the legislature's Health and Human Services Committee is one that would increase the ineligibility penalty for falsifying a general assistance application. Another would limit the amount of benefits to 275 days in a five-year period for a person without dependents and who can work. A third would penalize those who apply for general assistance even though they have usable assets. Senator Eric Brakey, a Republican from Auburn, sponsored all three bills.
The general assistance program, again, is intended as a safety net for short-term acute emergencies. However, Maine taxpayers increasingly find themselves paying into general assistance to serve longer-term purposes.
The LePage administration testified in support of the bills, but they drew broad opposition. Norman Mays of Shalom House in Portland says people on general assistance are among the poorest of the poor.
By creating even more barriers to these emergency funds for our neighbors in need, they will endure even greater suffering.
Several opponents testified that taxpayers are already protected from fraud and abuse in the program. Frank D'Alessandro is a staff attorney with Pine Tree Legal Assistance.
We think the general assistance program is critical to low-income Mainers, that it has protections to make sure that only needy people receive the benefit, and these additional requirements are just going to harm people without saving the state any money.
And Diocese of Portland spokeswoman Suzanne Lafreniere says the state needs to be compassionate in its treatment of the poor and help them through hard times. Lafreniere says it's a mistake to think that churches and other groups can make up for the loss of state funds.
Faith communities and not-for-profits in Maine cannot make up the difference. There will be definite casualties to these cuts. It is unfortunate that we have to come, it feels like, every 2 years in order to make this point.
Larger cities such as Bangor and Portland say they attract people from smaller communities that don't have needed services. One measure before the committee would shift the responsibility for paying the local share of the program back to an applicant's home community rather than the town in which they applied for help. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
A popular campaign tool used by aspiring legislative leaders in Augusta could be taken away under a new bill being considered at the State House. Those behind the measure say it will reduce the exchange of money for influence between lawmakers and the industries they're supposed to regulate. Steve Missler has the story.
The proposal essentially outlaws political action committees that are run by members of the legislature. Last year, more than 20 leadership PACs received over $1 million in contributions. The donors included alcohol and tobacco companies, pharmaceutical companies, energy producers, finance, and high-powered lobbying firms.
What makes these particular political action committees unique is the fact that they are run by legislators, sitting lawmakers whose responsibility is to regulate the same industries that dump unlimited sums of money into their accounts.
Saco Democratic Senator Justin Chenette is one of the co-sponsors of the bill, and he testified before the Veterans and Legal Affairs Committee on Monday. He and other supporters argued that traditionally financed legislative candidates can receive no more than $400 from an individual or organization per election. But there's no limit on PAC donations. PACs not only allow lawmakers to circumvent contribution limits, Jeanette says, they also have a corrupting influence at the statehouse. That's because aspiring legislative leaders often use the donations to fund their efforts to become majority leader, Speaker of the House, Senate President, or even to obtain a coveted committee assignment. To campaign for these positions, they may host a party or event, or make a direct donation to a legislative candidate or another PAC, or maybe they'll purchase a radio ad or a round of mailers to help out a colleague facing a tough race.
That is akin to buying that support.
Former Portland legislator Cushman Anthony says the leadership PAC can be abused.
I view it as a subtle form of bribery.
There was nearly $1 million spent by leadership PACs last year. That's less than a third spent by the four so-called caucus PACs, which are operated by legislative leadership and that can take unlimited donations from the same industries, unions, and organizations that routinely advocate or oppose legislation. Caucus PACs would still be allowed to continue, even if the bill discussed Monday passes. What the bill would do is ban privately financed legislators from running leadership PACs. Supporters hope to build on a law passed last year that banned publicly financed candidates from running them. But to pass the measure, supporters will have to hurdle the ambitions of legislative leaders, none of whom are publicly backing the bill. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, chronic disease is the leading cause of death and disability in this country. It's also among the most preventable. A New Jersey physician who saw a dramatic improvement in her own chronic illness after changing her personal habits is now practicing what's called lifestyle medicine. A big part of her switch was adapting a plant-based diet. And as Patty White reports, she shared her personal experience at the Maine Nutrition Council's annual conference.
20 years ago, at the age of 28, Sarai Stanzik's life changed virtually overnight. She was a medical student working a 24-hour shift at a hospital. During a brief nap, she was awakened and called to the ER. But when she tried to get out of bed, she couldn't move her lower body. She was rushed to the ER, given an MRI, and a diagnosis.
I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and that changed the course of my life.
Stanzik continued her medical training and became an internist and infectious disease physician. But for 8 years, she says she struggled with her MS. Despite taking what she calls a parade of pharmaceuticals, the disease continued to progress. Then, one day in her office, she stumbled on a study that connected lifestyle choice to health. It piqued her curiosity, and as Stanzik researched further, she found evidence that diet has a profound impact on health. And she decided to do something radical, go off all her medications and adopt a plant-based diet.
My disease improved, and today, nearly 22 years since my diagnosis, I'm medication-free and doing very well.
It's unclear whether other factors may have contributed to her improvement. And though she doesn't advocate that patients with MS drop their medication, Stanzik now practices lifestyle medicine. She coaches patients to eat a mostly plant-based diet, be active every day, get adequate sleep, avoid tobacco, and reduce or eliminate alcohol. The importance of adopting these healthy habits may not sound revolutionary, but Stanzik says it's a prescription that's not typically offered by physicians.
Medical students aren't getting this information, and it's so important, so that we are all speaking to it, all physicians, regardless of your specialty, that we value and understand the importance of lifestyle in regards to not only preventing disease, but also managing and reversing it.
Too often, Stanzik says, physicians prescribe drugs that alleviate symptoms but don't get at the root cause of disease. And many patients don't address their lifestyle habits until they become ill. But when they do, it makes a difference. Maine General Hospital dietitian Venus Gilley says her diabetes patients experience weight loss, improved digestion, and overall better health when they eat more vegetables and fruits.
Americans tend to eat more protein, and their plates are generally half filled with protein. And if we can reverse that and fill half the plates with fruits and vegetables, they'll be healthier.
Nurse Allie Miller says she saw her cholesterol drop when she adopted a plant-based diet. But encouraging her patients at the Maine Veterans Home to eat more produce tends to be an uphill battle.
There's no sponsor for Whole Foods, you know? Like, it's the processed foods that have the advertisement money and the push behind it. But there's nobody speaking up for plant-based whole food nutrition.
But Dr. Stanzik is. She says if other physicians start to speak for it too, it could help change the course of the nation's chronic illness epidemic. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
On a recent gray day in Portland, a small group of people gathered to open a box they've waited years to see.
So there we are, and I hopefully soon will be holding him in stone like we're holding him in memory now.
It's a late chapter in a saga that began more than two centuries ago, a story of justice twice denied, or at least delayed, for an African-American Mainer who served the nation at sea. Fred Bever has the story.
William Brown was likely born a slave in Maryland, but he later settled in Maine, then a part of Massachusetts. In 1799, when Brown was barely an adolescent, he enlisted in the U.S. Navy, and he played a role in its first major victory. It started with a hot trade dispute with France that became known as the Quasi-War.
The Quasi-War broke into an outright shooting war at sea in the early days of February 1799, when the USS Constellation met the French frigate El Insurgente off of St. Kitts and Nevins Islands.
Herb Adams, a Portland native steeped in Maine and U.S. history, says William Brown served in that battle as what was then called a powder monkey, or as Adams says,
a powder boy. That is, he, being small, would race barefoot from below decks up to deck to the men fighting the guns during battle with leather buckets full of black gunpowder, and had to keep this routine up, down, as long as the battle lasted.
And it lasted, Adams says, about an hour and a quarter.
Before the French frigate pulled down its flag and lost its masts in disarray and surrendered to the Americans. It made Captain Thomas Truxton of the Constellation an instant and enormous American hero.
But it forever scarred William Brown, as a shipmate would later attest.
In the engagement, said Brown was wounded in consequence of the discharge of a musket in the top of the enemy's vessel, entering the foot near the ankle and breaking the bones of the foot.
That testimony was submitted to Congress some four decades after the battle in an effort to help the now infirm Brown win recognition of his service and a military pension. The archives show that a number of Mainers would join Brown's petitions. Other shipmates, doctors and surgeons who swore to Brown's long-term disability, pension agents, and big-shot Portland lawyers, including then-Senator Hannibal Hamlin, later Abraham Lincoln's vice president, who wrote of his good character and truthfulness.
It was his service that was in question and not his color. But frustrating as it was for him, this man lived and limped all his life, working as a sea cook, on the ocean and on land. He was a cartman, that is, he'd haul things from A to B, never able really to walk well, and regaling children in Portland about his stories of life at sea because the Congress wouldn't listen to him.
Brown hit some major roadblocks. He was told that because the Quasi-War was never officially declared, no pensions would be offered for service before 1800, or his name didn't appear in military records, or papers were lost, letters unreturned, Congress adjourned before acting. More than a decade passed between Brown's first attempt to get a pension and the day it was won.
And eventually, in 1854, in August, he was granted a pension of $96 a year by the United States Congress. Unfortunately, he had died in May 1854. His pension arrived after he had died.
And Brown's story might have ended here, where he was buried, in Portland's Old Eastern Cemetery. But for the past several years, Herb Adams and a handful of like-minded Portlanders have made it their business to identify African-American citizens who were interred anonymously in this quiet 5-acre swath of grass and gravestones overlooking the sea. They focused on those who served in America's early wars.
They could not, if they were a soldier, be buried beside a white man they had fought beside. Such were the days. And therefore, this area tends to be fairly open because, of course, they, as a general rule, could not have afforded stones.
4 years ago, a Maine historian named Larry Glatz chanced upon the National Archives' trove of quasi-war documents misfiled under the War of 1812. He notified Adams of William Brown's story, and the two sleuthed their way to an application to the federal and state governments for a veteran's headstone. As with Brown's original pension request, this one, too, was a stop-and-go affair.
Government then, government now. You know, there's paperwork, there's bureaucracy.
Larry Glatz was dogged, though, once again offering proofs of Brown's service to the authorities, making repeat requests, following up, making calls, answering questions. And finally, late last month, they got the news. The Veterans Administration had dropped off a new headstone for William Brown at a city garage. It's made of white Vermont marble, about waist high and narrow, like the headstones at Arlington National Cemetery.
The stone is inscribed very simply, William Brown, USS Constellation, 1786-1854.
That's Larry Glatz, who was on hand as the inscribed granite piece was unwrapped at the garage.
It's nice to see USS Constellation. That's great.
Although, it is.
It would be nice to have a date, you know.
Well, we can see
quasi,
if that can be a
quasi-war with France, you know.
Quasi-war.
Yeah.
It's a quasi-stone until then.
Sometime this spring, the headstone will be set over the section of the Old City Cemetery where, for more than 150 years, William Brown's grave has gone unmarked.
He fought for a country that didn't recognize him appropriately in the short life that he had, and he is still one of us, and we owe him this.
The sons of France our seas invade, destroy our commerce and our trade. This time the reckoning should be paid to brave Yankee boys on board the Constellation.
For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Fred Bever.
We sailed to the West Indies in order to annoy the invaders of our commerce, to burn, sink, and destroy. Our Constellation shone so bright, those Frenchmen could not bear the sight. And away they scampered in a fright from brave Yankee boys.
For more of today's news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Monday, April 10th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.